Before we dive into today's conversation, I want to take a moment to thank this episode's sponsor, Audible. You know how much I love a good story. I write them, I read them, and sometimes when I can't sit down long enough to open a book, I listen to them. Lately, I've been listening to Audible while I walk, travel, or even sometimes while cooking dinner. There's something about hearing a story performed that makes it come alive in a different way. I just finished, Julie Chan is Dead by Lian Zhang. An Alice Feeney book, Beautiful Ugly, and the latest Lindley book by Elizabeth George. So I'm going to be honest, this is how I do it. I get a book both on Kindle and on Audible, and I go back and forth listening to both. So when I'm driving in the car or with my son at some activity, I will listen to audiobooks, and then when I'm home, I read them on Kindle, and Audible makes it easy to switch back and forth in the app. Honestly, I do it every time. I want to keep the book going while I'm driving. And so I just switch to the audiobook. And then when I get home, I switch back to the Kindle because honestly, I can read faster than I can listen. Anyway, the best part is that with Audible, you get a 30-day free trial. You can start listening today. You get one audiobook you can keep forever, even if you cancel. So if you've been wanting to read more stories that pull you in and won't let go, including my own Casey Court series, which are all available on Audible, go to audible.com. The link is in the show notes or in the alternative ebooks.buzz/audible.
Hi, and welcome to The Politics of Justice. It's me, your host, Amy Austin. Good morning from Los Angeles. It's actually a lovely, lovely morning, but I had to close the windows because now battery-powered cars make this really weird, like, high-pitched sound when they're driving, and you can pick that up on the microphone. It's the oddest thing. Anyway, it's June. We're here. It may even be sunny later today. Who can say? So when we left off with Ransomed, it's the beginning of chapter 19, and I will say this. I was like skimming the chapters that I was going to cover today, and I think I spend entirely too much time thinking about furniture. So let's get to it. In chapter 19, it's December 21, 2003, and we're at Casey's building. She's actually standing in her neighbor's apartment. She's getting dressed for a date with Tom Brody. And the first highlight says, either I went for clothes that were too tight, imagining the thin self I used to inhabit, or they were tense as I tried to hide what my body had become. Not even a ringmaster looked good in a tent. For reasons unknown to me, there's some lines in books I like it. So the note says, I write a lot of words, a lot. Occasionally, I love some of them. This last line here makes me laugh every time I come across it. It's true. I don't know what. Probably because I went to Ringling Brothers as a kid. Do not recommend. Let's not discuss the animals in that show. But I did spend too much time at the circus, which, by the way, I never liked to go. So she is getting ready for this date. She's wearing like a wrap dress, which I think is the solution to all dress problems. And she's sort of grappling with what it means to spend time with Tom. He dumped her. That's what the background of the first Casey Court book, the thing that made her an underdog, the issue that is discussed in detail in Disgraced. But she's back at the trough, maybe? And it's just, you got to feel for somebody who is going down a path of something that's not necessarily resolved, but should be. So she gets in the car and they're driving through Cleveland, and she starts to really think a little bit about why it is that he contacted her out of blue. He dumped her. He felt she was a liability. He's obviously, in the meantime, dated somebody who was a net positive or a net benefit to his reputation, to his family, to the money situation, whatever it is. And she's really spending some time trying to figure out if that indeed is the case, then why is he back to her? And I mean, Casey has a lot of positive attributes, but net benefit socially, probably not the case. So they pull up to one of his family house, and she said the family was in full force in the formal living room when we arrived. It was like Ethan Allen showroom threw up in here. So I will say this. The note says this was the aspirational furniture of my youth, somehow a step up from the Macy's, which my parents preferred. Oh, I hated going furniture shopping at Macy's. It was like, it doesn't matter. It was in New York, like in Madison Square Garden. It had 7 floors in Herald Square. And basically the furniture was like on the top floor, and you take these like long escalators or like an ancient elevator in an old New York building to go to the top floor to look at furniture at Macy's. So when I was younger, all I ever wanted was like Ethan Allen furniture. I don't even know how to describe it. So the thing, the little frolic and detour I went on before recording is that I, of course, went down to see what Ethan Allen furniture was now or is now. And I actually don't like it anymore. It seemed like a poor mix of early American and mid-century modern. And mid-century modern would not have been a thing when I was a kid because it was considered old fashioned back then, to be frank. So I guess now, like 50 years later, it's in fashion, I guess. 70, oh my God, okay. 70 years later, it's in fashion again. I hate aging. Okay, so moving on. I can go down a rabbit hole about furniture because then I started looking at other furniture. So she's in this house with the Brodies, and the Brodies are an influential rich family, which if you've watched anything like The Gilded Age, you know that to be rich is to be corrupted. It's like saying that there's no ethical billionaires. You can't acquire a huge amount of money that I know of without engaging in unethical behavior. There's probably some person, but I don't know that person, in at least in the US, and certainly not in Europe. Oh my God, so much unethical behavior. Okay. Moving on. So she gets there, and Casey had that like encounter with Judge Eamon Brody, and she says, "I don't know what I thought a cheater's wife would look like, but this wasn't it." So what she encounters that I guess she didn't know is she's in a wheelchair. She's having some issues. And the thing that I actually note here, which is interesting because I thought I didn't think this before, she said, "Women always wonder about the other woman and really it's about the man." And that's true. We have all these like terms, like she's a Jezebel and like all these like misogynistic terms about the other woman. And I'm not saying that person is blameless, although sometimes they don't know. But it's really about the man who betrayed the marriage. Like, he's the person who made the agreement, and he's the one who engaged in the betrayal. So she's in this house, and it's really interesting because this is what she had always wanted, and now she has a second chance to have what she thought she always wanted. But I think it's tainted a little by life experience, by having been excluded from it before. And she's looking at it not necessarily with the same lens that she had previously. So they take her on the tour of the house. There's a housekeeper who's like serving dinner. She finds Eamon being very like graceful and rolling his wife over in the wheelchair to the table through the pocket doors. And it's just not what she thought. So I think this book may have been influenced. I don't even know it couldn't have been influenced by the time. Skip it. I was going to say it'd been influenced by something, but I hadn't listened to that yet. So they're sitting down to have dinner. And previously in this book, Casey had really spent a lot of time comparing herself to the beautiful Lizzie Confrancesco and how she was a step up from Casey, and now Casey's a step down from this woman. And what she encounters at this dinner is not what she thought. So the family's talking about it, And Patrick Brody says, what's Antonio Confrancesco up to? He's still building. And another brother, Liam, answers, I hear he's putting together a big project on St. Clair. That townhome he tried to get us in on? Liam nodded. Yep, didn't need us after he got redevelopment money for doing an enterprise zone. What Lizzie's father did to Simon needs to be rectified. Tom's brother Simon set down his heavy silverware. You don't need to fight my battles. I lost. That guy played dirty. I don't think that St. Clair subdivision is going to get out of zoning review in 2004, Patrick said. The men all nodded. The wives sipped their wine. I blinked several times trying to process what had just happened. I was about 98% sure the beautiful Lizzie Confrancesco and her family were going down. It would probably be a tough 2 to 7 years for them. Because Casey's reflecting on what had happened to her. And the next line is, if her family had been squashed like a bug in less than 10 minutes, stalling my career had only taken a second. And people like the idea of power, but it's pretty brutal to see it in action. It's the thing that I think when we watch period dramas that's really compelling is that people with power, with like, like a snap of their fingers, with a snap of their fingers can change the course of someone else's life. And it's something that's just so fundamentally unfair. Anyway, the note says, sometimes we're only a footnote in others' lives. Yeah, I mean, in her, what happened to her after the Brody family sort of scuttled her job obviously changed the course of her life. But given how they just like scuttled this other guy's like future, it means that to them, it was just Tuesday. So, and that's hard to see. So they're talking about, so the next thing, and this is the thing that's really, it's such a contrast, because after they've like scuttled the Confrancesco's family building on St. Clair building project, Patrick Brody turned on the charm and beamed it all in my direction. So how's your practice going? And she says, better, thanks, with Judge Brody's help. It's off life support. And they're like, are you interested in doing criminal again? And she talks about like she's only willing to do felonies, which is actually something I did, because if you do misdemeanors, you have to go to all the different city courthouses, municipal courthouses in Ohio. And if you just do felonies, you can stay downtown, which is also true of domestic. You could just stay downtown. So they said, he says, I'm next up on arraignments. The judges had to do, I believe, 2 weeks on arraignment. And so maybe a judge did arraignments like once a year or a little once a year, every year and a half. Because it's a lot. It's a whole morning of just felonies, like coming in and out and arraigning them according to the law and the requirements of felonies in Ohio. So she says, I can practically hear my bank account fattening, because if you stop by in the mornings, I can kick a few F1s your way, which would mean, I think, $1,000 to $5,000 per case. Flat fee, but arraignments were a gravy train and people stood in line to get the gravy. So, and then he asks her the thing that's really sort of hard is that she has been doing these juvenile cases for $250 a flat fee. She's wanted to sort of get out of it, but hasn't been able to. And so Patrick says, how about juvenile? You ready to be out of there? And she was like, you know, because she had just gotten a case from Brody. She's like, oh, you know, there's Ellingwood and, you know, some other cases. And he's like, do you want to do any more of the appointed cases? And she doesn't want to say that she's ungrateful for these $250 cases, because they've certainly been something that she's used to keep herself afloat. But Patrick says the money ain't shit, which is so true. So he says, this is such a power move. He says, I'll talk to the judges. And if you give me a list of cases, I'll have you out of all the assigned cases tomorrow. Write up an affidavit talking about press of business. It was this phrase that everybody used to get out of things, you know, due to the press of business, I can't X, Y, or Z in Cuyahoga County. And then she they're like, I'm going to get you out of these cases. And then they start talking about, well, you know, since you're here, we'll start referring some divorce cases to you. And we'll certainly replace the money that's lost from like giving up the juvenile cases with better cases with clients who pay more money than the state or county is willing to pay for, what's essentially pro bono work. So she really is sort of struggling with it, because then like they leave and then Tom is like, you know, trying to make out with her, which is something, you know, they used to do obviously when they were dating in law school, but for some reason it doesn't feel the same. And she said, she's like, time slipped away. She said, I couldn't tell the difference between this minute and minutes like at 7 years ago. We'd sat on the same couch and made out before, after his family dinners. 5 more minutes of kissing and maybe in one of the guest rooms taking off our clothes. And Lulu, who's her best friend, had often said that every woman was a prostitute. I wondered what I was trading sex for. So she really like sort of just struggles, I don't even know what to say, with knowing that there's something off and there's something different, but she can't pinpoint it. And while she's sitting around thinking about it, money is going to flow her way from the referrals that this family gives her. Moving on to chapter 20, it is a Claire chapter. And now it's December 29, 2003. We're getting to the end of the year. And she had gone to Chicago to spend the holidays with her parents and her child. And she says, she's like, maybe I should have stayed with my parents. She said, but after 2 days of my mother's sighing and silent recriminations, I'd paid the $50 and taken the long train ride back to Cleveland. So she left her son there. She was like, you can have holidays with Luke. He loved his grandparents. They loved him. He's innocent. But they're still angry about her choices that led to her having this child and being involved with this child's father. But obviously you can't take it back. But they lent her money. So, you know, strings. So in chapter 20, she's just home. And she decides to go see Judge Brody to figure out what he wants and sort of, how can I say this, like, get it over with. So she goes to his office, and let me say this. Whew, at this time of year, like the week between Christmas and New Year's, the courthouse is obviously open because it's a government business and it doesn't close for like a week. But essentially, it is a ghost town. So she comes in and he's like, how is young Darius? And he goes through all these things. And he's like, oh, you know, he says something. Did you enjoy Christmas? And when I didn't answer, he cleared his throat and said, Kwanzaa. No comment, but you know, if you know, you know. And so he talks about like, oh, my kids love that kind of thing. And she said, I looked in the watery blue eyes, thinning gray hair, jowls. His kids probably hadn't been four since the Nixon administration. Sorry. Makes me laugh. Anyway, he says, I think we could be friends. Seriously, I didn't have any old white friends. What would we talk about? I almost laughed out loud trying to picture us in a bar together. I'd get a Cosmo, he'd get a Sherry. We talk about shoes, shopping, dating, and waiting lists at assisted living centers. Yeah. So I didn't watch Sex and the City back then. I didn't have cable, and this was maybe before the Netflix era, where you can like watch shows that you hadn't been able to see because you didn't have cable. I believe it's an HBO show. But I still knew that people were talking about Cosmos and Sex and Dating because despite not having watched the show, the whole thing was like in the zeitgeist at the time. That's all people talked about, like women like having a Cosmo in a bar, like discussing their dating life. So that's the reference in there. And let's just say, I hope I got it right. One day I'm going to be right up on popular culture. At the time it's popular, just you wait. So he's trying to, I guess, like flirt, because maybe in his eyes, I always wonder about this about predators, the relationship is different than what he imagines. I mean, I imagine Harvey Weinstein thought he was dating. I don't know. I don't know why I said that. But I imagine if you talk to them, they would be like, no, it's consensual. Like, I invited her in and we had chit chat. And the next thing you knew, when they ignore the extreme mismatch of power. So he's like, he's just like trying to like chatter up. And she's just trying to think like how she can get out. And fortunately for her, she said, God answered my prayer and my phone rang. And it's her mom. And she's like asking her about what kind of dinner her child would prefer, whether it's fried chicken or spaghetti. And she was like, he treated him like a prince with no opinions. And she's a little annoyed that they don't ask the child himself. But at this time, she's sort of like not gonna go into like that family dynamic, because like that's too much to deal with while this judge who has no good intentions is there as well. So she says, playing up the moment, do you need me to come right away, you know? And she says, I'll be there in about 20 minutes. And her mother's like, what? So she is grateful for having made up the excuse to get out of this meeting with Brody. But he's not going to let her go. So he says, what's your schedule like tomorrow? And she's like, I have a kid, parents, holiday stuff. And he's like, you're trying to brush me off. So he says, you'd be best served not ignoring me. So she hustles her way out, but she knows. She said, was it a date? He wanted sex. My imagination was working overtime. I couldn't believe I was taking Rhonda or Kiana seriously. So she's, despite all of the red flags waving and his behavior and what she's heard, she's struggling to believe that this man is really trying to use his legal, I guess this case, advantage in his favor. But we'll see what comes next. You know, a little naivete. So she's trying to brush him off, but he doesn't want to be brushed off. So he says, Miss Claire, I'm disappointed in you. I thought we'd come to an understanding, but you seem to be ignoring me. A little reminder of my determination, maybe calling on you shortly. So she's like, the message is cryptic, but she's still like struggling to believe what is true is true. But not like a few minutes later, Darius, her baby's father, calls her. And she said, did you make bail? She said, because his family wouldn't pay bail. And he said, I didn't even waste a phone call. He's like, they haven't changed. She said, no, I'm free and clear. He said, everything has been dropped. I'm 100% out of the system as of 2 hours ago. So when can I see my boy? So even if she was insisting on misbelieving how Judge Eamon Brody would use his power, she has gotten a sneak preview of what can happen if she doesn't give him what he wanted. And she doesn't want to acknowledge what it is that she believes that he wants. I think it's hard for anybody to acknowledge that like somebody with power would abuse it so blatantly. Moving on. So we're at chapter 21 and it's a Casey chapter. It's December 29th. And Casey is visiting Lulu, her best friend. And she says, Lulu's first line when she walks in the door is, did you sleep with them? No, hello, how are you, Casey? Can I take your coat? Would you like something warm on this cold night? And so Lulu, like reluctantly, they were all raised with manners. She was like, takes her coat, offers her hanger. And says, are you happy, you know, like that I've done like the social niceties? And Lulu's direct. Let me use that word, direct. So she's like, did you have sex? You know, used to have sex. And she's like, she's just being rude. And she said, you know, your belief that every woman is making a trade-off when she sleeps with a man. And Lulu's like, did you make the trade? And Casey admits, and this is the thing like about having friends, she admits that there's a lot of appeal there. They have money and political power. And she, you know, now that 7 years have passed, Casey has grown somewhat. She grows a little bit more, I think, in the series, and is a little bit more reflective about what it is she thinks she wants from this relationship. So she explains to Lulu like what they did with the Confrancesco clan, and Lulu's like, what did that family do to them? Lulu's brow pulled together, deepening the groove between her eyes. Clearly spinning was not my forte. I'd leave prettying up the dirty to Ari Fleischer. Oh, that's like a political reference. I haven't thought about that in ages. Anyway, she's like, I have no idea. Didn't seem polite to ask. Maybe I should pause between the salad and soup. Hey, you're declaring war. Might I ask the motivation? She was like, I kept my mouth shut. I'd already been on the business end of the Brody's gun. So she talks about how they got her out of juvenile court, how in the last like week since that dinner, she's gotten like all these cases, like thousands of dollars of cases. And it's just, they did make, I mean, like for all of their corruption, I guess, or misused influence, they did, keep to their promise. So she was like, and Lulu does say this, I know those cases are like anchors, but they kept the Casey boat afloat for years. And they're like, she's like, can this case and then all of that, you know, pay the bills? And Casey says, the Brodies, they giveth and they taketh. And the note I wrote is actually small town truths. I know Cleveland's a city of like 300,000 now, but it felt like a small town in the way that it operated. So, and so Lulu was like, holy fucking shit, no wonder you were mad. And she said about Tom dumping you. She was like, if you were right about what you were going to get if you had married Tom. So, you know, in addition to Casey getting, let's call it the white picket fence fantasy, and the 2.3 kids or whatever, she also would have gotten whatever that would have brought her at a big firm. So probably similar referrals, just on a much larger scale, that could have really propelled her career in that kind of private practice. So then Lulu, so Casey's like clearly ambivalent about Tom. And so Lulu says, you should ask Miles Siegel out, she said with surgical precision. And I don't know if Casey knows that there's something about Miles that intrigues her, but her friend clearly saw it. So Lulu goes to this like thing about how after Casey and Tom had left the wine bar that she'd asked him a bunch of questions, she lays out his whole resume for Casey and talks about how Casey should give him a chance. And again, Lulu presses about this Tom issue, and it's, I will say this, when Casey is talking about, her ambivalence, the highlight is Lulu wiped away a fake tear. I made a mental note to get less irreverent friends. But the note I said is Lulu always makes me laugh. Friends like her are worth their weight in gold. Look, sometimes you need more sympathetic or empathetic friends, but sometimes, especially when it comes to dating, you need truth tellers. You need people who are going to be like, who are really just going to like cut through the BS and tell you the truth. So next chapter is 22. It's a Miles chapter, and he is going to a New Year's party. At Casey's apartment where Lulu had invited him. And, you know, Miles is, he's sort of intrigued by Casey because she's a bit of an odd duck. She's not conventionally attractive. She's not conventionally like flirty and like outgoing and all the things that like Claire is. Like Claire is like, I want you. I'm going to do this for you. I'm willing to be this kind of like woman in your life, this kind of wife. You just have to be this kind of husband. And so she's like 100% clear on the kind of thing she wants, whereas Casey is just out here. So he's at this party and the neighbors, Jason and Greg, sort of are grilling him. And Miles is like, what is going on? But what Greg sort of says is, oh, you met Tom? And Miles is like, yeah, her boyfriend, sure. And Greg's like, I wouldn't go that far. Tom has a lot to make up for. And so Miles is like, I just walked into the middle of a play and nobody told me what happened in the first hour. But Greg relieves him of that burden of ignorance and proceeds to tell like the whole story. And, you know, at this point we go through, so that happens, but then it's Dick Clark, who was also dead. So many people have died, things have changed, is doing the countdown for the ball drop. And then he pulls Casey into a kiss. And I think it surprises both him and her. He said, it was the second surprise of the night. I really liked kissing her, probably would have continued on, but her silence backed me off. And then he gets like, you gotta love the parents in this book, because then his parents call him and say, Happy New Year. And he's like, caught off guard, because his mom was like asking, like, what are you doing? And he's like, I'm at a party. And she's like, it's kind of quiet. And he's like, it's a progressive. So I will say this, because this like intrigued me. I've never seen it before or since. And I don't know if it's a Midwest thing or a Cleveland thing or some kind of thing I've never seen, not in New York and not in LA. Maybe in LA it's not possible. So they had these parties when I was in Cleveland called progressives. And basically people who knew each other on like a single block or couple of blocks would have like these parties where they would have like drinks at house one, or d'oeuvres at house two, you know, the main course at house three, like dinner at house four, I mean, dessert at house four, like a cheese plate, like, and then like sherry or port. Like, so it was such an interesting idea. And I haven't seen it since. They were kind of fun because you got to go to like different people's houses. You could like dip in or out, like a little less obvious, like you weren't so obvious. There wasn't any, what I used to call the Irish goodbye, but apparently the Irish called the French goodbye. But, you know, like leaving without really saying anything. The kind of things you had to bring were kind of small. So they were really interesting parties. So he's at the Progressive, but his mother has never heard of it. And so he hangs up because he's like, I'm an adult man at a party and I just kissed somebody and I need to get the hell off this phone. And Casey's like, you didn't have to get off at my account. And he's like, my parents would have talked another hour. And he says he's got the best parents he could have had. But then, you know, your parents and sex don't mix. So, you know, he has to shift his mind to that. And she's like, you know, thinking about going. And, you know, to the next, she's thinking about whether she should go to the next thing. And she's like, you know, no, I'll just stay behind, you know, here and help Lulu, like, you know, clean up. And Lulu's like, maybe you should go. And it, you know, they spend, her and Miles spend a little bit of time together. And it's clear, who knows, like drinks or whatever, that that they have an attraction. So Miles says, I took a deep breath and did two things I knew were dead wrong. First, I kissed her again. There was no mistletoe or flaming ball to blame it on. I did it because I wanted to. I did it because she needed it. And he realizes that like he kind of really likes her. And when they're back, they're both confused because he just got out of a thing and she's just getting into a thing, and their coupling would be inappropriate at this time. So they sort of back off and talk about the like the neutral topic that they can, which is work. And he's like, he's like, oh, I'm working on this case. And, you know, I'm going to be honest, after alcohol, like he's being a little loose in the lips. And talking about, like, you know, he's investigating the Brodies, and she's like, she knows the Brodies are corrupt. I mean, she just sat at that dinner, but knowing that they're being investigated and to this extent is a little off-putting. So Casey's literally like, you don't think the women were doing it voluntarily, because she has to, like, hold, not disparate truths, hold the whole truth in her head, is that this family who would be willing to, like, end her career or put, like, a huge wrench in the Confrancesco, like, building scheme would also be engaged in sexual impropriety. And so Miles is like realizing that she may have more information, obviously, you know, having dated Tom or dating Tom, she would have more information than he is privy to. And so he's like, do you know something about Judge Brody? And she's like, I'm not doing this again. She held up both hands, pushing away the imaginary person. He says, doing what? She says, going up against a big family. I lost big last time. He says, but, and she says, do you see this? She asked, gesturing toward the ceilings, wall, carpeted floor. She's like, I can finally pay for this. My loans have added deferment. I bought this outfit new and I have to worry about my card was going to explode under the department store checkout. And he's like, I don't follow. And she says, I'm almost done with my penance. I crossed the Strohmeyers. I paid the price. And the note says, I know this is a moral quandary for Casey, but this is her first time living the life she thought she deserved. Turning a blind eye to the latest Brody wrongdoing may be easier than facing what's right. That turned out very badly for her the last time. So that's the end of this video, because I'm at my time limit, I think, for these videos, which ends up being about 35 minutes. And I got through 94 chapters, so I'm pretty happy about that. So if you want to help to support the channel, please be sure to like, subscribe, share, comment on the video. I don't think I'm eligible for hypes, but if you can, hype the video. And I will see you next time with the next Casey Court Dilemma. And actually, the next recording may or may not be from Budapest. I'm going to fly out in a day or two, but I might record again before, because, you know, it's a gray morning. I got to put the bike away. I got to, like, take it out of the car and, like, actually put it away. So I may have more time on my hands when I've done some more packing.